Okay, so this is Sabrina George, New Comedy Radio, on the south banks of Thames on a pretty breezy, cool May day, interviewing Scott Capiro. Hi, Scott.
Hi. There's a crazy person next to us talking to himself. He talks about being, he keeps saying fat now. And he is a bit chubby.
He's kind of paedophile looking, a bit worrying.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, first question, what was the first action you took to get into stand-up?
First action,
I Yeah, certainly. Rather than thinking about it.
I took an improvisational comedy course from a failed stand-up comic in Marin, which is a suburb of San Francisco. I was trying to meet an actor, one with whom I'd fallen in love, who'd been born on my lucky day, which is April 16th. So I knew we were meant to be. So to meet him, in the summer, I took an acting course, which turned out to be an improv course, which kind of got me started in stand-up, because eventually I realized that the people on stage were not helping, they were hindering my happiness and success. So I looked around and thought, why are these people here? I could do this on my own. And I eventually did. And I eventually became a host for a variety show at my high school. And I joined the drama department by then to meet this actor who became a drug addict and then a dealer, and then he's since disappeared. Turned up 2 years ago living next door to me. Anyway, the point is, at the time, he became out of the scene and I became sort of, for the first time in my life, popular because people thought, oh wait, you're in the drama club. You're not gay, you're just a freak. Now we get it, you're a nerd. So I played it. I played the nerd card. And they asked me to host this variety show because I couldn't do anything else. Couldn't sing, couldn't dance, couldn't act. I said, sure. And I turned what had started as a 30-second introduction to a show into sort of a 10-minute comedy format for myself using props. I wore a cardigan. I played it up. And then at university, they offered a stand-up comedy course in my acting degree in Los Angeles, which I took the course. And it reminded me how, compared to other forms of presentation and performance, how stand-up is by far the easiest format for me. And I fought it. I wanted to be a proper trained actor. That's what my boyfriend at the time was. That's what I wanted to be. Immediately, I got a commercial agent. I was very commercial at the time, apparently. Tall, skinny, nerdy. Funny. But I didn't take my audition seriously, unfortunately. I got a lot of good movie callbacks for films that became quite successful that I kind of pissed away because I just thought, well, I'm a proper actor. I'm not going to play some nerdy guy. I mean, you know, now I cut off my left arm to get a part in a movie like that, but at the time, you know, I was very precocious.
And what were you doing at university?
I was studying acting. That's why I'm here, in a way, because I finished my final year of my degree at Birmingham University in Britain, made friends, and then years later came back for a film festival here at the National Film Theater, actually, and to attend, because I made a short comedy film. And while I was here, I met a comedy promoter, did some gigs for him. He said, you should try Edinburgh, which I didn't know what Edinburgh was. I thought, when
Edinburgh
he said it was a
festival,
I thought it was a few caravans and, you know, a billboard. Seriously, I showed up in town with absolutely no knowledge of what to expect. On the day of the parade, with my bags, going, why can't I cross the street? Oh, there's 3 million people in front of me. So, it's good I didn't know what I was up against, because my first year at Edinburgh, in the 94 year, I brought a play over, not a stand-up set. A play that had not done well in its previews in London. In fact, in the middle of my presentation, at some, I can't remember, it was a pub out there, about 80% of the audience got up and walked out simultaneously. And there were two gay men in the front row, only people who stayed. And I said, isn't that awful? And they said, we think you're disgusting. And then they crossed their arms and they sat there and watched the rest of the show. The staff had stayed in the back, the girls, cocktail waitresses with their boyfriends. We think you're lovely. And I told my manager at the time that. He said, I think you should only do stand-up at Edinburgh this year. I think you should drop the play. And I'm like, fuck that. I paid to come here. I'll do what I want. I'm from San Francisco. These nobodies can't tell me what to, you know. And so I went to Edinburgh with a bit of a chip on my shoulder, thinking I'll show this tiny town. And then, you know, you show up and there's millions of people in 4,000 venues. But I ignored all that. I went right from my tech. I'm right from my tech to the show. I was exhausted. It's really good. And then, you know, there's some people in the audience that night. Someone from The Guardian being one of them. And then in a week I was sold out. They moved me from a 40-seat venue to a 250-seat venue upstairs. I sold out the rest of the run and won the Perrier for newcomer. And I think that none of that would have happened had I thought, oh, I should plan this better. I should take control. You know, I let nature, as I say, take its course. And it was a positive outcome. And I didn't mean to be. Even then I wasn't a professional. I just left to play. I was still doing plays and acting.
Here or back in San Francisco?
Back in San Francisco. including that play that I presented in Edinburgh that year. And there was a gay and lesbian performance space I was working at a lot as a comic and as an actor. Still thinking, you know, I was doing a lot of TV and film then, because in San Francisco they really used it. The LA had moved up, cheaper to produce it. They've since moved on to Canada, but at that time they were using San Francisco a lot. I was getting TV commercials, and I did, that's when I did Mrs. Doubtfire, and another film, and then, you know, Mars Candy and all this stuff. I was making a lot of money doing that, and I thought, well, to me, stand-up is still kind of for fun.
Pick up guys.
Right. Never have. Never. It's never worked for me that way.
It hasn't.
I always thought that maybe it would, and I stripped in front of an audience, desperate for attention, but it's never resulted in that. Picking up girls, maybe. I've had business cards passed to me during shows by women, but not by men. But I think men are too competitive, actually, for that. But anyway, so then it snowballed here. And then the film stuff started to dry up in San Francisco. As I said, they moved on to Canada. And then the stand-up comedy venues shut down. There's only, well, it's coming back now a bit, thank God. But for a while, there were just two comedy venues left. I was working both of them, but there's no way you can make a living. Thank God I had found this market. And I think that's why at the time, the late 90s, a lot of American comics started to come over here, because it's rock and roll here. There's still a lot of work, a lot of business.
So you are now living in London?
I just bought a place. I feel like I have cancer. I feel so polluted having signed all those forms and signed my life away to those monsters, those real estate people. Oh my God, they're horrible. We're dealing with 3 months. I'm sure I have AIDS. I'm sure it's their fault, mostly. But yeah, so I'm determined to... I'm Sagittarius, so this is difficult for me to say, but I'm determined to commit to both my life and my work here. And I've been coming over so much for the last 10 years anyway, it seemed ridiculous to continue to rent. I was torturing my friends by sleeping on their sofas. It was ruining my friendships. I want a real life. I'm 43. I thought if I sell down just a bit here, I'll get more work and a boyfriend. Probably not in that order, unfortunately, because the work's more important to me, but I think... You know, to get the work here, you have to be here. It's like L.A. I lived in L.A. for 3 years, and to get the work in L.A., they want you to suffer like everybody else has to suffer. And they're certainly not going to sign you a contract when you're sitting on a beach in San Francisco with your Labrador.
Really?
You have to be in London.
Suffering.
Mm.
Yeah.
Just like eating the bad food, you know, as your skin pales to an even more sallow color than you ever thought you could become without having the AIDS or the cancer, which I might now have. But I think... I enjoyed, you know, looking for a place or feeling like a grown-up. It was fun at first. Then it became a chore. But now it's all done. And now, apparently, I'm living in Bethnal Green, where Lee Hurst's comedy club is. And apparently, he won't book me. I don't know why. I thought we were friends. But he's quite selective, I guess. Or
yes,
so I
he
hear.
Is.
Yeah. So,
it doesn't take girls or gay men.
I guess. I love Lee. I think he's one of the best compares I ever worked with at the Comedy Store. A club he no longer attends. I still do, and that might be the reason he doesn't book me. I guess he has a stick in his craw about the Comedy Store, but I guess in the meantime, I'm not working for his club, which bothers me, because the comics he does book are all friends, well, not all, but most of them are friends of mine, and I'd love to see Lee again. Again, I think he's so prolific and so talented, and always sort of, you know, I've been told I can't play clubs before. Very few times. I've been very, very fortunate in this country in terms of reviews and audience response, other than last night, and, I hope that ship sinks, literally. But, you know, I've been lucky. You know, I've been restricted very few times.
And just to go back a wee bit, when you started off doing your 10 minutes, emceeing, writing your own 10 minutes, whatever, what sources did you draw on to come up with your comedy?
Well, it was that way in San Francisco. In the US, it's more of an apprenticeship, where you start out as the compere, and then you build a set, you build a 20-minute set, a 30-minute set, and then suddenly you're a headliner. Hopefully in 5 to 7 years you're doing an hour-long show. It's different here, isn't it? Because the compere is oftentimes the most accomplished performer on stage, at least as much so as the headliner. So by the time I got over here, I had a strong half-hour, strong hour, really.
What was your material coming from?
It was coming mostly from my family.
Right.
And mostly from my sexual experiences and experiences as a gay man in a mainstream heterosexual community. Some political and social stuff. I was a poli-sci major in Irvine. And,
what's that?
I was a political science major for years. I mean, I gave up the degree to pursue my acting because they conflicted, unfortunately. I wish I'd done it the other way around. But I'm fascinated. I read all the papers every day. I mean, I'm fascinated by all that stuff. And I really like hypocrisy and the way people lie. So I tried to catch the audience in lies. And a lot of the plays I'd done in San Francisco, including a kind of a long-running, really trashy end-of-the-pier hit, was set in a bar, and I played a gay bartender. And part of my job during the second half of the show was to invite the audience and bring up the house lights and talk to them. And so that became part, easily became a part of, it segued into my comedy act. I was never intimidated by an audience as a comic. And I really like including them in the show. I think it's a way for me to get some of my points across more readily. Is that they see me as less of a monster than I sometimes, you know, present myself as. So,
I was going to say, the first time I saw you, I think it was Late Live, I can't remember now, but I remember a couple of your things. It was a bit like taking acid. It was just incredible. I was just sitting there going, he can't say that.
Well, last night I was getting a lot of that.
And you got this roar of a laughter when you got to the punchline, because it was just like, whoa, where's he going with this one?
Well, that's what I hope for, because traditionally, a mentor of mine, Alex Bennett, a radio show host in San Francisco, noticed years ago when I was doing his radio show in the morning, just how I built a straight audience in San Francisco and in California. And really, radio has a lot of power here too, as you know. And much more, I think, than television even, in building a local and a national audience. And Alex noticed, having watched me many times, he said, it's funny who you are, because your setups are filthy, but your punchlines are clean. So the setups scare the hell out of the audience, because they don't know what's coming. And then by the time I roll onto the punchline, they're like, oh, that wasn't so horrible. That wasn't as bad as we thought it was going to be. It's like when people tell you how awful something is, and then when you get there or see it, it's not so bad. I like that anticipation, and I like that idea with the audience that they don't know what to expect. That's what I think good stand-up is, for me, is the audience not knowing what's around the corner. I never want them to think that we're friends, that they can tell what's going to happen next, that they know me. Because that ruins it for me. And last night, playing this boat down the river, I thought that the audience was in for a bit of a roller coaster ride, because they seemed to applaud as though they knew who I was, and some of them did, and some of them liked it, but there was a vast majority of that room that was just horrified by what I mean, the Guardian reviewed me in Edinburgh this year, favorably, luckily, and they said, you know, you would think that people know what to expect from Scott Capro, especially in Edinburgh. I've been playing it for 12 years, and it's a small room. I mean, most of the people in there, I think of the 60 or 70 or 80, probably knew who I was, but some still don't get it. And I would never go to a live performance without doing a bit of research, especially without bringing my children. Anyway, so... But people are lazy or careless. I don't know. They have a lot on their minds. And so they get there, and I think that they hope... I think that when people are offended, especially nowadays, since 9/11, everyone thinks that their opinion is of equal importance, which is a big mistake, because my opinion is the most important. I have a microphone, the show's about me. I mean, clearly. And they feel offended because they think I'm picking on their sensibilities. I told them last night, I don't know you. We're not friends. I don't mean that in a horrible sense, but I'm not a juggler. I'm not a clown. If you want that, go to a children's party. It's like what you're getting here is something from someone that doesn't know you or care about you. That's the beauty of it. You can walk away from it anytime you like, which is what the exit door is for. If you don't like it, you'll wake up tomorrow and forget about this. And I said to the audience, it's just 20 minutes out of your life. And some guy yelled out, 27, which I thought was hilarious. And I gave him that. Now, that's funny. That's you being involved, watching your watch. That is little... I wish I'd thought of that, and next time I'll use it. Somehow. But what it means to me is that guy, whether he enjoyed the show or not, at least had a sense of humor about what was going on. I may have not been his cup of tea, but he certainly wasn't going to ruin what was happening for the rest of you. I mean, half the room was like, shut the fuck up, we're enjoying this, you know? It was really just a couple in the back who left when I left, and I followed them out. Without the knowings behind them, I recognized her voice, and she said, well, that was awful. I've seen this twice before, and that was by far the worst show. And I'm like, she was on a date with some guy, and they were dressed up, and they were city people. And to her, you know, I was the devil. And who knows what her issues are? That's what I mean when I said, I don't know you. This is not about you. I'm not here to make fun of you. It's reassuring for me to say that. Otherwise, it would be an attack on you, and I don't care about you. More or less, to attack you. And I think the people... I think one of the things I like about comedy, and why I think it's elitist, and it should stay that way, it's selective for a reason, because I think people think when they go to see a comedy show, whether they enjoy it, or even if they don't, or mostly if they don't, that they've been selected by the comic. I think it's an aphrodisiac, because people think, if they like you, that you've found something out about them, you've connected with them in a way that other forms of performance and art don't. That's why they keep coming back. And that's why comics get laid so often. Most do. Me, not so much. But most do. And
because I remember one of the earlier reviews I read of you was homophobic gamer.
Yeah. Homoneurotic, maybe, but homophobic, I don't know. And, you know...
Well, I sort of saw what they meant, because it is turning a lot of preconceptions about what it is to be gay or what your thoughts are, and that you don't really want to be included in the group, but you do.
And well, I think it's funny because I just did a show for a gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender center in San Francisco. There's an I in the
it
Q.
It sounds fun.
Listen, I know. It's a mouthful, isn't it? Isn't being gay isn't a mouthful enough? It's an LGBTI.
I was just going to say, I'm coming from Middle England. What do they do with the toilets?
Well. Well, they're Victorian, aren't they? They're unisex. But it was LGBTIQ Center, and I didn't have enough time on stage defending myself, so I met with the IQ stands for. Apparently the Q is questioning. And I'm like, whatever happened to closet case with you people? Am I old-fashioned, or is that still my favorite term, and it shouldn't be? But I told them, why do we need this center? San Francisco is an LGBT center. We should call it the Cox Center, because the whole world is cock-centric, just like you and I. But what's transgender doing here? She's a straight woman. What does she have in common with gay men? Other than the bitching. And what is it bisexual care? They get all the rights. They didn't like it when I said all this. Because they like their little center, right? They like their little their night out in their tuxedo with their boyfriend, because they can hold hands. It wasn't actually in San Francisco. It was in a suburb. And believe me, the burbs are the hardest audiences, because you know, it's just 45 minutes south of San Francisco, but it might as well be 45 years, you know, it might as well be Arkansas. These people act like they're so victim, it's so punishing, you know, and I did my act, which is what they hired me for, and the board of directors came up to me afterward, one of whom said, I was completely offended by your act, and I'm like, which part? And he couldn't remember, which is typical. He couldn't remember which part offended him. It was so important for him to tell me, but he couldn't recall the bit. And the woman running the place is transgender. And I outed her during the show because I asked her if she was straight or gay because she'd mentioned her boyfriend. She said, and she's gorgeous, looks like Jessica Lange in her good years. She said, actually, I'm transgender. And the audience, and I'm like, you guys didn't know? And then people, you outed her. It's a the T in transgender. But, you know, we don't talk about it. It was very English in a way, I thought. Oh, we would never talk about that or discuss it. We've never. So, you know, I don't feel in a way that much more comfortable in front of a gay audience. I don't play them. There's no circuit for gay men in this country, really. It's Diva as a Dragon gay bars. I wish I could play them. They pay a fortune, but they're horrible toward gay men on stage. And my last resort is straight clubs. And usually it's lovely, but it can be a bit horrifying. And I don't have anywhere to run.
I think I don't play gay clubs. You have a second set that can be for a tamer.
I do.
You do? You do. You have a tamer set.
I do.
RAF pilots from the Second World War in Tunbridge Wells.
Oh, I have bits that are still gay, but they're much more gentle, but I feel dirty when I do them. Mm. See, that makes me feel dirty. I feel like, why should I let the audience down? Why should I babysit them?
And did you start off like that, or did that come upon you?
I was cleaner when I started. I had to be, because I was an opening act. The show wasn't about me. I couldn't make the show about me. And I was definitely friendlier, and my material's more gentle. But of course it would be. I was, God, it was 1990, so I was 28, 26, 27, 27, 26 maybe, so of course it was gentler, 27. And I wanted to be loved and liked, and I'm not so much concerned with that anymore.
When did that switch happen? Was there a specific moment?
I think
it was
when
gradual?
I started making a living at it.
Right.
And I was performing 5 nights a week, and I thought, I'm wasting these people's time and my own. This is important time we have on stage, it's very limited. And I want to squeeze in as many new ideas for these people as possible. My act has a flow, and I expect each idea to feed on the next one, and I expect the audience to notice that. And that's probably my downfall. Because I want them to see, oh, that was clever. Oh, I see where he's going with that. Ooh, I didn't get that. Well, that's a callback to that. Like, to me, it's, you know, it's a bit of a crossword puzzle for me. It's like putting it together, you know? That's the fun of it. And I think that's why my act has relatively done well in this country, because I do a lot of puns, and a lot of wordplay, and a lot of innuendo. But my setback, as far as my mentor might be concerned, and as far as some TV people might be worried about, is that I'm not camp, I'm gay, and there's a difference. And what this country has been most comfortable with, in the last 50 years at least, is camp gay men.
It's Julian Ferry. Yeah.
Well, you know, Julian could be.
Lillian's. Well, he's fantastic.
As we know, and
yeah,
quite challenging.
Oh, God.
He said something on TV, you know, 8 years ago that he's still paying for. And I've seen Julian's live act, and I find Julian to be. Whew.
But I think the reason why
others.
He can get away with it is because he's camp. When he first arrived,
yes,
he was in the full prop, full
yes
makeup.
Oh, yes, definitely.
And he's no longer yes anymore. And it allowed it to sneakily come
sure
in underneath.
Makes it's part of his brilliance. And there are other comics. You know, Graham and Alan Carr. I mean, these guys are extremely severely camp. And so it's what people are most comfortable with. Whether they're comfortable or not, it's what they are most comfortable with. But, you know, I'm predatory and contradictory. And I'm conflicting in my act. And people that don't want to be challenged don't like that. And why people that don't want to be challenged, who are Christian, sitting in the third row of a comedy club in Leicester Square on a Saturday night, is anyone's guess.
It's a mystery.
But they did rush the stage 2 weeks ago, and I had to poke her with the mic stand to get her away from me. Because
right.
I don't want to hear how much Jesus loves me, no matter what I say. And neither does the rest of the audience.
Because you know it already.
Yeah, I know. He loves me. I'm a Catholic school for 12 years. He loves me and he hates the Jews.
So when you're writing material, and obviously you want people to laugh, but what else do you want from it?
Well, I want them to be surprised. And I want them to leave the club having one or two ideas in their head that they didn't have before. Otherwise, I feel like, well, what's the point? I tried to do those other sorts of sets that aren't leading, where jokes don't lead into the next, where you don't need to do callbacks that aren't full of innuendo and play. And I can't memorize the material. That's my problem. I can't do ambiguous oranges and shopping carts. Like, I think what Eddie Izzard does is lovely. I've seen his live act of Hen and Chicken in a room of 50 people. He's totally intimate and gorgeous. But I can't do that. I can't sew a button on a jacket and talk about... It's not how my mind works. And this may sound tired and hack, but I'm going... There's a point at the end of the trip that I have to reach. And if I don't reach that point, I haven't done my job. And they have to go with me. They have to. And I can't stop. And it's part of the reason why I don't take very many breaths on stage. Because if I do, they're going to start thinking too much about what I'm saying, and they won't travel along. And it's why I love performing in Ireland so much, because the Irish know that they're funnier than the performers on stage, and they're not defensive and competitive, and they'll play along with you, and they're there for a laugh. And they have more of a cuddly relationship with Americans than the English do. And last night, I probably burned a bridge when I told the British that, thanks for that thank you letter they sent for saving their ass in Iraq one more time. We appreciate it. Well, maybe we'll grab that and pin that to our wall at Christmas. And the audience was extremely offended that I'd even imply for one moment that it was their fault we were in Iraq. And, you know, just saying that worked them up to such a dither that it was like throwing down the gauntlet. Then we were off and running. That was the Anne Frank jokes, and I'm talking about fucking my black boyfriend in the mouth and him fucking me with this big black Indian cock, and you know how black men are in bed. No, we don't. We actually don't know. Well, okay. Then you're the racist one, I guess, and it's not me, isn't it, after all? So... I mean, a lesson to the audience, if anyone out there is listening to Ghosts and Comedy Clubs. The more you push, the more we pull. It's better to play along. It's like you have a gun to your head. What are you going to do? Say yes or no? It's better to say yes. You might leave there alive.
Have you ever left a gig and found a posse of people outside wanting to beat you up?
That gay gig last week in San Francisco. People came after me. One guy grabbed me by the arm. Two people did. And I told them to get their hands off me. And my friend wanted to leave, and I said, let's hang out and see what actually happens. A letter was written and passed to all the people, the thousands that have been there at the show or that are part of the LGBT, sent to the radio station I work for in San Francisco, and they read it out aloud on the air, and people called in, and oh, it's just a mess. Said, we do not support this emotional vandalism. I think they said emotional vandalism.
Fantastic.
The gazer, oh yeah. And this sort of racism and puerile sensibility about minorities. They remarked about my act as if I was heterosexual. I thought my mother would be so proud. I mean, they read it out on air. I was in San Francisco, but I called the radio. I said, what are you guys doing? I've heard, oh, we thought you had framed this and hung it on your wall by now. I'm like, yeah, I guess, I don't, you know. I have had, you know, a lot of comics have had threats. I think it's the booze more than anything that makes it threatening. But the gays was probably the AIDS jokes. But I thought, if I'm going to make AIDS jokes, where else am I going to make them? In front of my gay brothers.
Yeah. What can you do?
They worked my last T-cell, that audience, I gotta tell you.